want to turn to First Chronicles. We'll pick out some highlights from this book. And some of you may notice that we haven't done Second Kings yet. We did First Kings, and now we're doing First Chronicles. And the reason that I'm doing it that way is because of the fact that First Kings and First Chronicles kind of cover the same time period. And then Second Kings and Second Chronicles are going to cover, to some degree, the same time period. So we're going to do them this way, kind of, I guess you'd say, in chronological order a little bit, to try to keep straight a little bit. You know, the books of the Bible, as they're in our Bibles, weren't put in chronological order. Most likely, the first book written was Job, and yet they're over there in the middle by Psalms. And yet most of the scholars tend to think that Job was actually written around the time of Abraham, and that it was actually written well before Moses wrote any of the Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, which is interesting, and we may discuss that some more when we actually get to Job. But certainly the things about it seem to fit with that. But they aren't in a precise order. They're grouped according to their types. My Sunday morning class, although they don't know them all yet, they're working on learning the books of the Old Testament too, and learning those groups. We know the first five books are often called the books of law or the books of Moses. And then we have these books of history, which is really from Joshua all the way through Nehemiah. And even Esther is sometimes thrown in there, though Esther's kind of a hard one to put in one category or another. And then Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, those are what they call the poetry books. They're more poetic in nature. And then you have the prophets. Well, we have to realize that a lot of those prophets, the major prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, and of course Jeremiah also wrote Lamentations. But those four prophets lived during the times that we're reading about now. And then the minor prophets, the last 12 books of the Old Testament, from Hosea on, they also lived, many of them, during these times that we're reading about here in 1 Kings and 1 Chronicles and 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. And so it's kind of difficult for us sometimes to realize the order that the events occurred in, because we just look, well, this book comes before this one. And we don't often think about the fact that, well, just because they came or in that order in our Bibles doesn't mean that's the order that the events that they discuss occurred in. So we do have to think about that as we're reading and studying in our Bibles. When did these events occur? And it's helpful. There are books that will have kind of a Bible timeline of when the big events were. You know, this is when the flood occurred, and this is, and after that was this event, and so forth, and this is when the children of Israel went into Egyptian captivity, and this is, and they came out, and it'll kind of have on that timeline where those books, what period of history the books cover. So we know that, for example, the book of Genesis covers about 2,000 years worth of time. That's a lot to cover in just about 50 chapters. So then the book of Chronicles maybe only covers about 150 years. So that doesn't, that, you can't always tell. Now, you also, as you read through the books of the Kings, you'll read about two different books in there. One that you'll read about is the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. The other one you'll read about is the Chronicles of the Books of the Kings of Israel. And many times the writer of the book of Kings will say, is it not written, or are the acts of such and such a king not written about in the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah or the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, depending on whether that was a king of Judah or a king of Israel. What we have in our Bibles, the First and Second Chronicles, are the Chronicles of the book, the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. As far as we know, the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel is lost to us. We don't know what happened to those books? Now, the books of Kings, 1st and 2nd Kings, deal with some of the things of the kings of Israel as well as the kings of Judah. Remember, the kingdom divided after Solomon died, when his son tried to force the people into heavier and heavier work and heavier taxes. That might be something our government might want to think about, that you push people just so far when it comes to taxation, and eventually some people are going to rebel against that. It happened in the nation of Israel. They had been taxed hard and worked hard under Solomon, and then when his son came in, they wanted to take a little break. They wanted a relief from that. So the book of Chronicles, though, is going to go all the way back to Adam, and it's going to start there in Chronicles chapter 1 and verse 1. And it's then just going to give one of the genealogies, because remember, there were many, many people on the earth. So this is just one particular line, one genetic line, if you will, that this book is following. And think about, if you will, what's significant about the line that it follows. Well, what's significant about it is this. The line that the Bible is following is none other than the line through which Christ is going to come. It's not concerned with the lines, the genealogical lines of all the other people in the world. It's only concerned with the fact that after Adam and Eve sinned, the world needs a Savior. And God promises there's going to be a Savior. Now, how are we going to get from here to there, where the Savior comes? And so that's why it follows the line that it does. And, of course, in that line we have such great patriarchs as, we remember Methuselah, who as far as recorded history goes, the oldest living man. That doesn't mean he was the oldest, it's just he's the oldest recorded. There may have been others that lived just as long or longer. Noah and Adam, of course, and then, of course, as you come on down, you've got Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and then the 12 sons of Jacob that then begin to form the nation of Israel. And remember, the whole purpose of God forming that nation of Israel is one goal in mind. He wants to bring the Savior into the world. And that's the nation that he's going to use to do that. Let's look down to verse 19. Somebody you might not have ever heard of. Verse 19 says, "And unto Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, because in his days the earth was divided. And his brother's name was Joktan." You might note Peleg there. And in fact, his name itself means division. And it's interesting sometimes to note some of the meanings of some of these names. They named people particular things for particular reasons back in these days. You know, we just name our children, you know, oh, well, Aunt so-and-so was named such-and-such, or Grandpa's name was this, or whatever, and so we're gonna, or, well, that's just a pretty name, so we'll name our child. But they didn't really do that a whole lot back in these times. When they named a child something that had a meaning. And that meaning was very important many times. Had a significance to it. Because it meant something. It wasn't just a name. It was a description of that person's character. I think the Native Americans or the American Indians also used that practice. They would name somebody, you know, here's Sitting Bull, or here's Running Bear, and they gave them names that had a little more meaning. We do that more with nicknames. You know, we might call somebody Shorty, or we might call somebody Slim, or, you know, whatever the case might be, that we give a nickname to somebody that fits some characteristic about them. And many times those are done in love and goodwill sometimes. Particularly with children, those can be done out of anger or hatred or envy or some other cruel intention. But notice Peleg's name means division, and it says that it was in his days that the earth was divided. Peleg lived during the time of the Tower of Babel. So if you want to put a cross-reference there back to Genesis chapter 10, That's where the story of the Tower of Babel is. And of course, you remember that story, the people were trying to build the tower up to heaven, and because of that, God, Genesis 11. They were trying to build this tower up to heaven, and God got angry with them for doing this because they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing. They were wasting their time with this tower and not spending their time doing what he wanted them to do. And they also were being irreverent to him. But he went down and confused the languages, and it wound up dividing the earth. Not the earth as in the land and the planet, but the earth as in the people. Divided the people according to the languages. And verse 8 in particular says, So the Lord scattered them abroad upon the face of the earth, and they left off building the city. So we see then that it was during this person's lifetime that these events took place. And then his brother's name was Jokshan, and we're not told what that name means, but I'm sure it too had some sort of a meaning. There certainly were many that did. Just an interesting sidelight and a good question for you. How many sons did Abraham have? Some might say, well, he just had one, Isaac. Isaac was his only son. And others might say, well, no, we know he had two because he had Ishmael by Hagar, and then he had Isaac too. But did you know that Abraham actually had eight sons? At least eight sons Abraham had. Mark verse 32, it says, now the sons of Keturah, Abraham's concubine, that she bare Zimran, Jokshan, and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shua. She bore six sons to Abraham. And that was after, from all accounts that we could get, that was after Sarah died. After Sarah died, Abraham took Keturah to be his wife, after Sarah had died and had buried her. But it's interesting then that Abraham had all these sons, but Isaac was the special one. And Isaac was the one, the only time. You know, we read all the time in John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. The only other time that phrase is used is in reference to Isaac and Abraham. And we think, well, that's kind of odd, because if Abraham had eight sons, how is this his only begotten son? Well, the phrase only begotten really carries more than that just only son, but it carried with it the idea that this is a unique, one-of-a-kind, special son. And he was special because he was the son that was born by Abraham's wife, Sarah, and that was born miraculously, you might say, after the age when they shouldn't have been able, at least Sarah, shouldn't have been able to, you know, men can bear children. I don't think it's fair to say men bear children. Women bear the children. But a man can father a child, you know, many times as long as he lives. But women do pass through an age where they can no longer bear children. So this Isaac was a miraculous birth. And when we think about that and our relationship with God, too, even though Jesus is his special, one-of-a-kind, unique son, the only begotten son, but we, too, can be sons and daughters of God. But not in the same way that Jesus was. But we can be children of God. Just as Abraham had other children, but they weren't like Isaac. So that's just an interesting side note for us there. Then in chapter 2, verse 3, we see that in the Old Testament, and even into the New Testament times, God was much more active in the affairs of men than he is today. We see, I mean, he was right there. He was came down on the mountain and talked to the children of Israel. And nowadays, you know, when somebody talks about God talked to them, we start thinking, this is not quite right here with something. But here we see verse 3 says, the sons of Judah, Hur and Onan and Shelah, three were born unto him of the daughter of Shua the Canaanitess. And the firstborn of Judah, was evil in the sight of the Lord, and he slew him. God killed him because he was wicked. Now, sometimes we might think it'd be nice if God got back to that practice and just kill off some of these wicked people that we have, that they wouldn't be able to bother all of the good people around on the earth. But God was more active back then. I mean, he just, when somebody was wicked, God would just strike out against them. And so that was the case with Judah's son, Er. You might notice also verse 7, the sons of Carmi. It says Achar here, is the name A-C-H-A-R in the King James. It says, the troubler of Israel who transgressed in the thing accursed. You might put a cross-reference there to Joshua chapter 7. And now in Joshua, his name is going to be Achan with an N instead of an R at the end. But it's the same fellow. It's maybe an alternate spelling, maybe like the difference in Johnny and John or something. I'm not sure exactly what the difference there was. But the same guy, the son of Carmi. And the next time you're tempted to do something wrong, think about what you're going to be remembered for years to come. This, apparently, the book of Chronicles was written well after the whole kingdom of Judah had gone off into captivity and had come back from captivity. So we're talking about hundreds of years passing from the time of Joshua to the time this book is written. This man, Achan, or Achar as it's written here in Chronicles, has been dead for hundreds of years, and yet, what is his legacy? What is he remembered for? The troubler of Israel who transgressed is a thing accursed. How would you like to carry around a legacy like that and leave that behind after you die? For everybody for all time to remember that you were the one that caused trouble for everybody else because you sinned against God and did something you weren't supposed to do. What kind of memory is that to leave? So we need to think about the fact that the way we live our lives is going to be remembered, either for good or for bad. There was a study done of two men. One, a preacher, I'm not sure of the denomination, you may have heard of Jonathan Edwards, back in the 1800s, big preacher, very famous, but a religious man. The other, an atheist, and I cannot at the moment recall his name. But they both had offspring. Of Jonathan Edwards' offspring, only maybe one or two ever got into trouble with the law or had any problems of that nature. Many of his children became, things that are considered to be lofty goals, doctors, and they were preachers, and they were good, honest citizens. And this other man, who had been the atheist, it told the number, dozens of his offspring that wound up in prisons, wound up murdering other people, wound up committing all sorts of crimes and causing all sorts of problems for society. And the distinction there between two types of lifestyles, one that concerns itself with doing what's right, and the other which just says, I'll do whatever I want to do, and not be concerned about what's right. And the differences. And the legacy that those two men left for the world. Here's one man whose offspring, it would have been a joy to know these people. They were good people. And this other man, you didn't want to run into these folks. They might hurt you or kill you or rob you or, so we see the difference in the lives that we live continues on and on for generations to come. We need to think about what kind of a legacy we're leaving behind for our children and our grandchildren and so forth. I'll look to chapter 3. I might just put a mark there at verse 10. At verse 10 begins, of course, we know Saul and David were the first two kings of Israel. And verse 10 is Solomon, and then it lists the other kings of Judah. This is how we know that this is Judah we're talking about here. This isn't the kings of Israel. These are the kings of Judah. It doesn't mention the kings of Israel. It doesn't say anything. When it talks about Solomon's son Rehoboam, doesn't say anything about Jeroboam. So splitting off and starting the nation of Israel separately and dividing the kingdom. It doesn't say anything about that. But it lists on down through them. And these are many of these are the kings that we know or have heard of more often. You have Jehoshaphat, you have Hezekiah, you have Josiah. And then the last one, verse 16, the very last king was Zedekiah. And then, so you can put a line there between verses 16 and 17. And verse 17 and following continues to follow that royal line, even though they're not kings. Because remember, this is the kings of Judah, the tribe of Judah, that's where Jesus is going to come from. Remember, he is considered the lion of the tribe of Judah. So he's going to come from, and he's a king, right? He's not just some peasant folk he's going to be a king. He's in the line of kings. And so it's going to continue then in verse 17, this same genealogy, this same royal line. And even though the people had been taken away from their land and exiled, and many of them lost track of their genealogy entirely. They lost track of who was, you know, and in fact, when they came back after they had been the servants and enslaved by Babylon in Babylonian captivity, after they came back, there were a lot that couldn't prove that they were even Jews. They couldn't prove it by, you know, they hadn't kept track of their ancestry. Or they had intermarried with some of the Babylonians or the Assyrians or whoever else they might have come in contact with while they were away in captivity. And so they hadn't kept themselves a pure line. And so this then is the line that is followed that's going to get us to Christ. And that's of some importance because Christ had to show in order for many of the Jews in particular to believe that he was the Christ, there had to be evidence that he was of a royal line. If he's going to be the king and he's going to sit on his father David's throne, whether that be figuratively or the Jews at that time thought literally, but at any rate, if he's going to reign and rule as a king, he's got to be royal. He's got to have royal blood. We can't just have any old fellow sitting on the throne. Of course, they didn't seem to mind the fact that David was just any old fella. He was just a shepherd boy when they picked him, when he was chosen by God to be king. But then we have in chapter 4 and following some of the descendants of some of the tribes. It starts with Judah, of course, Judah being the most important tribe for several reasons. One, because obviously Judah was the kingly tribe. Secondly, because Judah was the tribe that received the blessing. The birthright. The blessing. I was right the first time. The blessing. Sorry. Joseph and his sons received the birthright, which was double the inheritance. But the blessing was the line through which Christ was going to come. Remember Abraham, of course, the blessing went from Abraham to Isaac, and Isaac also got the birthright. So Isaac got the blessing and the birthright. Then Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau was the older. Esau deserved to get the birthright and the blessing. But Jacob tricked him out of it, so Jacob wound up with both the birthright and the blessing. Well, Jacob then, normally it goes to the firstborn child. Reuben was the firstborn child. But Reuben didn't get to receive either the birthright or the blessing. And then Simeon would have been next, but Simeon also, and we may deal with some of the reasons that they didn't, but he didn't get it either. Instead, Joseph got the birthright, which was the double portion of inheritance. And that's why when we list the 12 tribes, there's not a tribe of Joseph. Instead of there being a tribe of Joseph, there are two tribes, one Ephraim and one Manasseh, for Joseph's two sons. But here in chapter 4, you might underline Judah there in verse 1, the sons of Judah. And then we look down to verses 9 and 10. This has become a big thing recently. Maybe you've seen books at a religious bookstore or something about this particular thing. I recall Brother V.P. Black sharing it with myself and some other preachers at a preacher's meeting long before it became such a popular thing, and now there are books and all sorts of things about it. Verse 9 says, "And Jabez was more honorable than his brethren. And his mother called his name Jabez, saying, because I bear him with sorrow. And Jabez called on the name of the God of Israel, saying, oh, that thou wouldest bless me indeed, and enlarge my coast, and that thine hand might be with me, and that thou wouldest keep me from evil, that it might not grieve me. And God granted him that which he requested." There's a big thing now, you know, the prayer of Jabez. And it is, it's a beautiful prayer, it's a good prayer. And you might spend a little time thinking about that first phrase, "Oh, that thou wouldest bless me indeed." Now that's not two words, indeed, which would be in actions or in work. That's not what he said. But indeed, truly, certainly. So he says, "Oh, that you would bless me indeed." Most people, when they're praying for blessings from God, they're praying for physical blessing, maybe financial blessing, maybe they're praying for health. And I think if you read this verse, you'll notice he does ask God to enlarge his coast, which would be indicative of some financial blessing, some physical blessing of some sort. He talks about keeping him from evil. That could even include keeping him from ill health. But he says, "Oh, that thou would bless me indeed." What does that mean for God to bless him indeed? Truly bless him. Jabez realized that there was more to the blessings of God than just food, shelter, clothing, and the physical things of life, financial gain and wealth. He realized that there was a deeper blessing involved there. Then we'll go on down in verse 24. You might underline the word Simeon. And then he lists his descendants. Then in chapter 5, that first verse, go ahead and underline Reuben there, and it's going to list his descendants. Notice what it says. "Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel." Remember, Israel is another name for Jacob. Jacob had his name changed from Jacob to Israel by God. God changed his name. And so this is the firstborn of Jacob, or Israel. "He was the firstborn, but forasmuch as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph." Pardon me. "The son of Israel, and the genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright." And so, here he lost his chance at the birthright. Because as a young man, or we don't know exactly what age, but as maybe I'm allergic to my own preaching, I'm not sure. But he didn't do what he should have done. And because of that, he lost the chance at his birthright. Simeon lost his chance at the birthright for another reason. I don't know if you may recall the story back in Genesis about Jacob's only daughter, as far as we know, Dinah, and how Shechem, the prince of the land of Shechem, took her, and whether it was by consent or whether it was rape, we don't know, but he engaged himself with her, and they had not been married. And when Simeon and Levi, her two brothers, two of her brothers at least, found out about that, and they made a deal with Shechem and all the inhabitants of the land, of that land, that if you will be circumcised as the Israelites are circumcised, then you can marry our daughters and we'll marry yours and so forth and so on. And they waited until after these men had had this delicate surgery, and these men were all out of commission, needing to rest up and recover from their surgery. You know, they didn't have outpatient surgery back then like we do today. It was a serious thing for them. And while these men were all unable to fight back, Simeon and Levi went in and killed every one of them. Killed them all. Didn't leave a single man alive. And so, because of that event, because of the fact that Simeon shed so much innocent blood, even. Now, see, Shechem himself may have deserved that. I mean, he took advantage of this young lady and took her honor and so forth. But the rest of the people living in his land had done nothing wrong, and yet they went and killed all of them. So because of that, Simeon lost his chance at the birthright and the blessing as well and everything else. Then you might look down to verse 11 and underline the children of Gad, and it's going to then list who the children of Gad were. In verse 23, the children of the half-tribe of Manasseh, remember, Manasseh wound up, half of the tribe of Manasseh was on one side of the Jordan River, the other half was on the other side. Then we come to chapter 6, we see Levi, sons of Levi, and remember Levi was the priestly tribe. And as we come on down, we see verse 49, that Aaron and his sons offered upon the altar of the burnt offering and on the altar of incense and were appointed for all the work of the place most holy and to make an atonement for Israel according to all that Moses, the servant of God, had commanded. God has always expected things to be done the way He wanted them to be done. He made it clear that Aaron and his descendants were supposed to be the priests. They were supposed to be the ones who actually went in and made the sacrifices. They were supposed to be the only ones that could enter into certain areas of the temple. And then only the high priest could enter into the most holy place. And then even he could only go in once a year under that certain condition to make the offering to atone for the sins of the people. And so here you have, though, the re-establishing that fact for the people that Aaron and his descendants are the ones that are supposed to be doing this. Remember back in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, and as they're out in the wilderness, and a couple of the other people got the idea that they could do the offering of the sacrifices just as well as Aaron could, and there's no reason he should be the only one that's the priest. And so they decided then, Moses said, well, we'll just find out. He said, you bring your censers, and Aaron will bring his, and we'll just see which one God picks. And God picked Aaron. Of course, God had already picked Aaron. He picked him again. He said, this is the guy. And of course, if you remember back in the book of 1 Samuel, we talked about King Saul. Samuel was supposed to come and make the sacrifice, and he didn't get there just as quick as Saul wanted him to get there, and so Saul went on and did it himself. And God got angry at Saul because that was not his place. Here he was. He was the king of Israel, but it wasn't his place to make that sacrifice. It wasn't that Samuel was any more important or that he was somehow a better person. It was just that this was the prescribed job that God had for this group of individuals, and this was the job He had for this group of individuals. Many times in the church today, women sometimes say, well, why can't women be preachers, or why can't they be the song leader, or the elders, or lead prayers, or why not? Are you saying that men are better than women? No, that's not what we're saying at all. Not at all. But all we're saying is, God said, this is the group of people that is to do these things. And this group of people is to do these things. And it's not our place to try to change that. We have to just follow what God has ordained to be the order of things. We'll start at chapter 7 next time, which will be in a couple of weeks. So we'll look at chapter 7. We see some interesting things tucked away back there in those boring old books of genealogies and big names and big words that aren't a lot of fun to read sometimes. But there are some interesting facts nestled in there, some interesting things that sometimes we overlook because we skip those things. So we need to be of the understanding that God didn't write these things for no reason. He wrote them for a purpose, and we need to try to learn as much as we possibly can from them. If you're here tonight and you have a need to respond to the invitation, maybe you, like Jabez, need God to bless you indeed. Maybe you need Him to keep you from evil. Maybe you've gotten yourself a little too close to evil, and you need to get away from that. Whatever the case may be, I ask that you would come as we respond as we stand and sing.